Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast.
No, whoa, you left me hanging. This time I'm waiting for it, and you don't do it?
I was waiting for a quote, so.
but we're not doing a quote on props and slops.
Oh.
And should we
start quoting one of the things we're going to talk about?
Can we quote any of the things we're talking about? Can I quote?
I guarantee we can quote the Tiger King.
I still haven't seen it, but. Let's introduce ourselves and talk about it. I'm Aaron.
I'm Roy.
That's Will Roy. They're from the very south.
I mean, you pretty much had us listed that way on the topic document, the outline for this week. So, you know, it works.
All right. Billy Roy Rogers, please tell us about Tiger King.
Oh, who wants to go first? Okay. Roy's not piping up, so I'll start with at least my super brief synopsis, which is it is the most breathtaking train wreck of television I have ever had the privilege, horror. I'm not sure which word is right, but regardless, the privilege of watching. So. Yeah, it's intense. I saw my favorite meme that kind of summarizes part of this is one I saw a friend repost that I forgot to pull up again before we started recording. But it was basically somebody having a conversation trying to explain to their mom that they're watching this new show called Tiger King. And he says, yeah, there's an exotic animal loving zoo running. Like meth head, gay polygamist, presidential gubernatorial candidate, and I don't know, there were like four other descriptors, and the mother then says, wow, that's a lot of people to keep track of. And the guy says, oh no, that's just one character.
It's just one dude. Yep.
Yeah,
he's very exotic.
So exotic.
Right. So for those of you who haven't seen it, just real quick, it's a documentary series about tiger raising in the United States. And it focuses primarily on the character. I don't like saying the character, the person.
Well,
of Joe Exotic.
Joe Exotic is a character, though.
Right. But he's also a human being. Like, he's not.
Sure. But I mean, Joe Exotic Hamlet. Is the persona that Joe. Svartalberg. I don't remember his given last name now, but Joe Exotic is the persona he obviously spent years
calling. Right. Him and then his rival, an animal rights activist named Carol Beskin, and then there's a few more minor people who are in Joe's orbit. You know, one truly reprehensible cult leader who raises tigers. Several failed business partners of Joe, all these kind of things. But the central crux of it is Joe Exotic.
I just want to throw out about the side characters. It's mind-boggling to me that the X, possibly X in quotes, drug kingpin who went to jail for being involved in the dismemberment and burning of a federal officer is the most sane sounding person on the entire show.
Well, because he went through the shit and came back on the other side. So, you know, like, and he also ran a successful drug operation where it's very clear that very few of these people have run a successful anything, less something high stakes as, you know, being the largest drug dealer in the 80s Miami, which I can imagine is a high stressful entrepreneurial situation. Anyway, it is very good. It's extremely entertaining. You know, Joe is a fascinating character, a person, whatever you want to say. You know, like a lot of these, like, true crime docu-series, whatever you want to call them, that come that like really make a splash and become, you know, very ubiquitous, you know, like Serial and Making a Murderer and things like that. This one is the least obviously highly charged political, but it's still there. And I think there's a lot of I came at the end of it with a very like mixed feeling about it as an overall experience. Even though I enjoyed it, it was very entertaining. But I think that it's a very muddled series that gets a little too claustrophobic and obsessed. It buys a little bit of what Joe Exotic is selling a little too much. And the more you read about the case and the people involved outside of it, you come to see that the perspective that the documentary series offers is probably a little too narrow because it's a hard, you know, if you're making a TV series, a movie, a documentary about someone like Joe Exotic, it's like almost impossible for that not to happen, particularly when you're working with a visual medium and he's so just
in your face,
extra and in your face. And so just like sucks all the oxygen out of the room. And that's like one of the dangers of video is that, you know, these characters, you know, like you can see Joe Exotic in some ways is like a bit more benign, but he's actually not that benign version of it. But like, not to get too political, like people like the president are also similar like that, where they can take advantage of video as a meme and just sort of like draw the camera to them and suck all of the oxygen out of a scene, out of a sequence, and the cost of just the power of their sort of charisma on camera.
Yeah.
And Joe Exotic is that kind of person. And like, that's one of the dangers when you're dealing with a subject like that. So like, my advice would be to people to read the New York magazine piece that was written about Joe before the documentary series, to give you like a broader perspective that I think puts a lot of what goes on in the documentary series in a really useful frame.
I guess multiple things. One is, I think those are some great points about charisma, where I think casual folks, so to speak, can forget that charisma is a double-edged sword very often. And I think that is very evident here. Probably because high charisma also tends to go with large ego. Debatable which one's the chicken and which one's the egg, but regardless, they're often found hand in hand. And this is a prime example. I sort of wish I had read that piece. I stumbled into Tiger King on accident. I'd already watched the first episode before even realizing it had blown up into this thing online. I guess maybe one of the benefits of my more limited Facebook access these days. So this is my only exposure to these situations and people thus far. So you maybe have some more grounding here beyond what I got in the show. And here we go. We've honestly been pretty vague for most of this so far, but it's worth telling listeners again, we are a spoiler full podcast. And one of the things that I found that this documentary did that a lot of these style that Netflix is pushing out lately tackled to various levels, but I feel like this left really open-ended with frankly, all three of the most main personalities, Joe and shoot, you just said her name and now I forget her name, that runs the Big Cat Rescue. Shoot. Well, regardless.
Carol Baskin. Sorry.
Yeah, there we go. Joe and Carol and Doc. And how each of
Baskin, my wife just corrected
that. Baskin. Okay. Yeah. And Doc. And maybe even to a lesser extent, Jeff, who you're only introduced to in the last, what, two episodes, I think. And some, I sort of hate to lump like illegal activity into like different tiers of strength or comparative badness or whatever, right? But like breeding tigers and selling them is kind of like one level of scale, right? And it hits onto some of that, though most of it really is on the interpersonal drama. But it raises these questions of much more intense malfeasance on each of these people's parts, and really kind of only just raises that question and just says, hey, by the way, you think they're bad, well, they might be really terrible, and on to the next person, let's talk about them.
That's very
yeah true. Which is both kind of mind-blowing to watch and sort of dissatisfying in the end. Now I'm just really filled with a lot of questions right now. It sounds like you've had more grounding in some of the different perspective on this, Roy. Has some other coverage covered some things, or even just in Tiger King, has there been some stuff that's convinced you whether, say, Joe really did hire a hit on Carol, whether Carol really murdered her millionaire husband in the 90s, whether Doc is blackmailing people and euthanizing tigers and burning them, and and Jeff's, I mean, maybe framing people? Oh.
Well, how am I put this? I mean, I think that the basic facts of the story, I think, are presented in Joe in the documentary are probably true based on what I've read. And like one of them, like one of the big things that's actually very controversial, is, you know, this whole theory about whether or not Carol killed her husband or not. My wife believes that she did it.
I think I agree with you.
She's still on her side. But she's still on her side. But like if that had been proven, she would be in jail, sure, right? So there's sure. no. Like, and she hasn't been charged, right? Obviously, so that's a mystery. What, that's not
everything except for Joe is all alleged at this point, I think.
Alleged, right? So my working theory, what makes the most sense based on the facts, is that the other people involved in the story enabled the obsession that Joe had with Carol to the point in which he did do it. But they set him up, but he still did it. Yeah, he still did it. Like, it was, they enabled him. They saw that this was, you know, bringing the card games, a leak in his, you know, life, that his obsession with Carol was something that they could use to set him up, to get him to be like, you know what? Hey, you've been talking for 15 years about wanting to kill this woman. Here's somebody who will kill her. And he went through with it, and they then leveraged his willingness to act on this thing that he has been obsessed with and repeatedly threatened her on the internet, to the point in which he was blowing dolls that he had her face plastered on with guns. Like, it's one of the things that was really shocking to me about it, is just, it's just a reminder of just how much free speech for white people is pretty limitless, particularly white men. Because the things that that Joe did to care about and said about Carol without any consequences was just extremely insane to me. Anyway, and so my thing would be, they're all guilty. Which is that Joe went through with it, but And, you know, maybe if he had not encountered Jeff and his friends, he, you know, it may have just stayed at the level of making YouTube videos about threatening to murder her. But he was willing to go through with it. Now, that let Jeff and his associates, you know, flip him over to the feds and do a whole bunch of other stuff that's involved in that. Basically take Joe's livelihood away from him. But that doesn't mean that he's innocent. And that doesn't mean that at the end of the day, he doesn't deserve consequences for his actions. And one of the things that's kind of like left out in the documentary series that's developed more in other reports about Joe is he did kill tigers unnecessarily. And that was one of the other, many of the other charges that he was charged with. And one of the reasons why he got so much jail time. And it was weird that was kind of like tacked in at the end, that he's accused of unnecessarily, I mean, you could say murdering six of his tigers. And his own former employees and friends were basically like, yeah, he did it. He did that. So, you know, even within the context of Joe as an animal person, he comes off at the end as just really reprehensible. As much as you can have sympathy for him, because he's clearly been a troubled person. And, you know, growing up as a gay person in 60s and 70s, Oklahoma and North Texas is not going to be a very easy thing. But he's, at the end of the day, just a really reprehensible person who did a lot of really reprehensible things, as entertaining as he was.
And I mean, it kind of gets washed over until pretty late in the series, and even then it's almost blink and you miss it. But his actual like romantic, probably romantic in quotes, relationships were kind of dark too.
He's a predator.
Yeah,
like, I mean, he clearly preyed on young boys. You know, it's a messed up situation and upsetting, really. Like, that's downplayed. You know, I think to just double back, and we should probably move on a little bit.
Sure.
To Tiger King. The thing that I found really frustrating about the documentary, particularly at the end, is how it tried to create false equivalent between all the actors in the documentary series at the end. You know, that's like a minor theme that kind of flows through, but kind of it crescendos. And like, I read some reviews while I was watching it about that, and it's like, I don't know if that's the case. But at the end, they kind of double down on it and basically say that all these people, from Carol to Joe to other breeders that are mentioned, are just all roughly the same. They're kind of the same cloth. And that just is not correct. Like, whether or not you like some of the other people on this, like, even if you, for example, Carol being the big one, even if you think Carol might be opportunist or a little too obsessed with her own self-image, she's nothing. What she does is nothing compared to what Joe and his friends did, both to tigers, to other human beings, and, you know, just in general. And I found that very frustrating at the end, that it just like that false equivalency was sort of the note that they chose to end on.
I won't delve too far into that. Like you said, we should probably drop Tiger King here in a moment. So my parting thought will just be, man, I want to know how the conversation with the producer or whoever went between them and I'm not going to remember the names of any of Joe's husbands, but the first one, the one who barely has any teeth due to meth use.
He's not actually the first one. Joe's actual first husband died of AIDS.
Oh,
like that's not actually talked about.
Okay. Yeah. History. They don't touch on that at all. No. The first of the ones that we meet. There we go. But who, like, the conversation between the showrunner or whoever and him that was like, here, by the way, we're going to need you to be shirtless, sitting in a recliner in the just like worst setting possible, like every time that we show you for this interview. Would that be great? Sure. Okay. It's just kind of throws me for a loop, because it's obviously not his like natural setting. Like, that so much of it is footage of people doing their stuff around the various parks and sanctuaries and stuff, but this is him sitting there for an interview, so it had to have been staged that way, which is weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
Okay, that's my last thought.
Wow, I'm never watching that show.
All right.
Can't.
All right.
Like, it doesn't sound like it's for me at all.
So, my... Wait, was that a proper slot, people? Because, like, that's the name of the show?
I would say that I'm leaning at the end of it more towards a slop than a prop, but it was a worthwhile experience.
It was fascinating. I think I will still give it a prop for being like fairly compelling watching, reviewing, I should say, even if a lot of the content is kind of questionable.
All right, fair enough. Moving on from whatever that was. I've decided to play the Metroidvania on the Switch during break. So I'm playing two. The first one is a definite prop. It's Hollow Knight, which is considered one of the best in the genre for really good reason. It's amazingly gloomy, really difficult with like ramping difficulty, but like I don't really like difficult games, but it's so slow and the mood fits so well and it's so patient that I find myself like drawn to actually completing difficult parts instead of getting bored and doing something else. Super high props for Hollow Knight. If you have a Switch, please get this game.
Okay. I guess I need to get a Switch.
Yeah. Well, you can also play it on PC, and I think you can play it. I think it's on every system.
I don't know. Let's find out. Google is our friend. You beat me to it. Go for it.
It's definitely on Steam. Nintendo Switch, PlayStation 4, Xbox One, Mac OS, Linux, Microsoft Windows, Wii U, and Macintosh operating.
Okay.
So close enough to everything, yeah. So, get it, please. Like, legitimately get it. It is fantastic. I'm only through the first, like, 2.5 areas. It plays like every Metroidvania where you find a map, buy a map, and then you like have to search the entire area to figure out and get new skills to open up new areas, and then you have to double back and find things you missed the first time because your new skills open things up. All that stuff. But it's worth it. It's just incredibly worth it.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I've heard nothing but good things about the game, so that all makes sense to me.
You have any interest in the genre, you don't. Right. I think you would really like
it. It's not normally my thing.
I've
raved enough about it that I'm curious, so that's something.
Did you like Symphony of the Night? Because I played a lot of these, and there were... Like, I really liked a million years ago, the genre, and I... Like, there... Symphony of the Night, I want to say Aria of Sorrow were incredible, and 90% of the others are sort of weird, like, mockeries, and I don't like shooter versions of them at all. So this is just basically, like, perfect. But if you liked Symphony of the Night at all, like, strong.
I think that was probably about the last Castlevania that I played any of, so.
There were a lot of absolutely excellent, like truly phenomenal Castlevanias, but they were all on the, what was the precursor to the DS? Game Boy Advance. Game Boy Advance had a ton of amazing Castlevanias.
Good to know.
Not that I can, you know, I mean, I guess they're super, whatchamacallit, emulatable at this point. I'm aware that's not a word, but I'm assuming that you can emulate all of them with ridiculous ease at this point.
Yeah, man, I haven't messed with emulation in a while, but I'm sure it's come a long ways from when I was in college.
I would hope. If it hasn't, like, you haven't been in college for a real long time.
True.
I mean, I did super senior, so I guess there's that. I was there a little bit longer, but
same.
I did not. I did the summer after graduation to avoid super senior.
I
deliberately did it. A lot of the English classes were on a 3-year rotation, and since I transferred schools, I literally had missed out on some classes, so I stuck around.
Okay.
I messed around for 2.5 years of college and needed to spend 2.5 years.
That takes considerably more effort than messing up, I've discovered.
Yes, it definitely does. It definitely does. Rebuilding always takes longer than the destruction.
My second semester of college was very bad, but besides that, I was fine. Second semester, I decided that since the first semester was so easy, I should just not go to any classes. It was a mistake.
Yeah, you know, it's all a learning experience, right?
I mean, I made it, right? Like, I'm not still in college, so.
That's true. That's true. It's true. That's not too results-oriented.
I mean, you heard me just whining about magic, right? Like, result-oriented is the thing sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. All right. On to Dragon Age Origins.
Yeah. So, I've been... You know, it's slightly a moot point now that we've reached the point where something I might have an opportunity to talk about a little bit later is out, and then Final Fantasy VII is out next week. But, you know, with the spare time that I have with the quarantine, so I've been working in weird bursts where I'm working a lot and then waiting for decisions to be made that I can't make. And then, so I'm sitting around waiting for those. And then once those decisions are made, working a lot. So it's sort of a lot of really on, then really off, a lot of really on, then really off. So I've been casting around for something to play, video game wise, to sort of invest in as like a project. I tried getting back into Neverwinter Nights, which I think I talked about last time. I ranted about how it broke on me. So I tried Neverwinter Nights 2. That also broke. So that fundamentally bugged out after about 15 hours of playing it, where I was like, you know what? I'm not going to play games that old. Let's play Dragon Age Origins, which I had forgotten came out in 2009, which I did not realize, which blew my mind that it was that long ago. Speaking of college, I had only been out of college for a year when that came out. So I was like, wow, okay. That was a long time ago. But anyway, I haven't played it probably in 7 or 8 years. And I just have to say that I am really enjoying it. I will prop it. It holds up really well. It sits in a really interesting place, having just played a bunch of older American CRPGs. You definitely see some of the positive innovations that the genre was going through at that time. It's still got some awkward growth spurts as a play experience. I'm not super fond of the combat system. I think it's way too fiddly. But the story is just as well done as I remember it being. The characters are just as engaging. In fact, I find characters that I didn't really like all that much when I was, or I kind of like some only somewhat liked, like I liked them a lot more, you know, 10 years later, 11 years later. So again, it's definitely something that if you can get it on sale on Steam or Origin or whatever, I would definitely, and American style CRPGs or something that you like, I would definitely recommend it. And it's also cool if you play Dragon Age Inquisition but not play any of the older ones. It's kind of cool to see like how the series has evolved. And there's a lot of really cool continuity between Dragon Age Origins and Inquisition. But there's also some like discontinuity that's also kind of cool to see, because it's one of those fun things that if you're like, well, what parts of the mythos did they choose to accentuate and which parts did they choose to try to forget? And it's always kind of cool to see that evolution over time. So I would definitely prop it. And definitely if you're looking for an older sort of, at this point, classic game experience, it's a fun one.
So I'm going to slop the same exact game. I have not played it since it came out.
But unlike Roy, I found the gameplay completely terrible. I thought the story was excellent, and I suffered through, like, it's hard for me to remember much about the plot. It's been a really long time. However, I remember being unable to get through it because the gameplay was actively aggressive.
I mean, that's fair.
Like, it's just, I don't feel like it, like, I think it controls actively poorly.
Did you play on
Xbox?
Yeah. I mean, I actually originally played it on the 362, and it's not very good with the controller. I'm playing on the PC now, so, you know, it controls pretty naturally because it has the point and click interface. So, but yeah, I originally played on 360 because I actually, when it came out in 2009, I didn't own a PC capable of playing it, which is really funny to think about, you know, now with the graphics now. And my computer's old at this point. Like, it you know, Witcher 3 really pushes it to its limit, and that's even on low settings, but much less something newer. But, you know, at the time, I didn't own it. I only owned a 360 that I bought to play Mass Effect.
It's a good reason.
And I think Dragon Age Origins might have been, like, the second game I owned on the 360.
Oh,
because wow. I bought a 360, played Mass Effect, and then didn't buy another 360 game for a long time. So I just used it as a DVD player.
Yeah, I hated the 360. It's one of my least favorite systems ever. I was mostly an RPG gamer at that point. And okay. The RPGs on that system were, like, I got it, I think, partially for, which is part of the reason for my annoyance here.
Well, I mean, which type of RPG are you talking? Are you talking, like, JRPG? Because they were pretty...
Mostly JRPG.
Yeah. Lost Odyssey was the only one that I think really kind of nailed it in the 360 era.
I know I played that, but don't.
It's good. It's the Immortals, and the main characters, like, lost his memory and stuff. It's by what's his name, that left Square and started Mistwalker, if I remember right.
I would not know the name. I never knew.
Mistwalker was definitely the, yes, it is the game you're thinking
about. Yeah, but anyway, neither here nor there. But related to video games, as I so often do when we podcast, I endless scroll through Facebook, and just moments ago hit on a friend who is giving out Steam codes for a bunch of spare games and just saying, hey, while everyone's stuck at home, claim a game. I've got extras of these. Enjoy. And Aaron, guess what the third game and the first one that has not already been claimed by somebody was?
Hollow Knight.
It was. So I claimed it.
Claim it. Woo-hoo. You're really going to enjoy it. Get past the first slow bit, right? Like, you're going to have to explore. But once you're past the first, like, honestly, hour or two, it really, really gets entertaining trying to figure out what the hell is. Oh, and at the beginning, grind for the map. Unfortunately, you have to buy your very first map, and it's mildly expensive for the start of the game. But once you have your map, he gives you the map. You have to buy the thing that shows you where you are on.
Oh, okay.
But it's fine. Like, if you're good at reading a map, I happen to be actually terrible at reading a map. It's not an issue.
Okay.
But I will use that the entire game because I am absolutely locationally terrible.
Huh. It's an interesting art style. I had heard of it, but I had never looked at it before, so I'm kind of looking at screenshots and stuff now.
Huh. Yeah, it just feels different. Like, playing it feels... The feel of the game is very its own in a very positive way.
Cool.
Alright, next up, Altered Carbon Re:Sleeve. For Will.
This one's going to be pretty short. I was excited to see that Netflix just dropped more Altered Carbon content because I didn't realize they were going to do this. It's actually an animated film. It's like 3D CGI, like cel shaded. So it almost looks like if you played the Telltale Walking Dead games or something along those lines using that engine. Yeah. It almost looks like that, but it's got a very anime body style for a lot of the characters and the kind of movement. It's weird. It's short, by the way. It's only a little over an hour, so it's almost more like just an episode. And I would have liked to have seen like a new part of this world, but we just see Takeshi again in a new sleeve we've never seen before. And since we are spoiler full, I will say it doesn't make it super clear up front when this is set, but it is actually set before the first season, regular season of the show, because another character turns out to be his sister in an unfamiliar sleeve. And he, of course, does not find out it's his sister because you have to preserve that reveal in season one. But it's also it's weird. We don't learn anything new or different. I guess you get to see him meet the Yakuza boss that he is calling in a favor from in season two. Because that's who like brings him out of storage to do a job for him for this film. And that's about it. Some of the animation's kind of awkward and stilted. We see some tech, some like cyber ninjas and stuff that feels way above and beyond anything even that we have seen in the live action series. So just, I don't know. It doesn't feel like it accomplishes much other than to raise a couple questions about the world as a whole and why we're not seeing some of this tech elsewhere. So I'm not sure I can recommend it. I think I'm going to slop it.
That's fair. It didn't look very interesting to me, so I skipped it.
Yep.
So it makes sense.
Next up, The Infinite Loop.
Oh, we're going straight to my next one over the one from Roy.
Oh, sorry, I missed Letter to the King. Sorry. I've never heard of Letter to the King, which is why I forgot about it. My fault.
Which is totally fine. So Letter to the King is the new light high fantasy series that Netflix is pushing. It's apparently a loose adaptation of, I believe, a Danish, could be a Swedish novel from the 60s. But it's family friendly, focused on, it's a very traditional fantasy story, and it's a lot of fun. Like the cast is younger than a lot of fantasy series that have been, going on recently. They're like actual teenagers compared to, you know, either like Game of Thrones, which is all about mostly adults, but you know, obviously there's the Stark kids, but you know, most of the cast is adults. And then, or something like CW, where you have 25-year-olds playing 17-year-olds. It is actual, you know, young actors, and they're all pretty good. And it's just a fun series. And if you're the kind of person like myself who likes their fantasy a little bit on the more traditional side, in its plotting and on the lighter end, Letter to the King is a great option. I will definitely prop it. And it's definitely if you are the kind of person who has kids, like, you know, that are in the like, you know, six plus, and they can sort of follow the plot, I would recommend definitely watch it with them. If you're a fantasy fan and you want something to watch with them, since we're more time at home, it is definitely a really good option. So I'll definitely prop it, and I'm excited for if they do another season. Knowing Netflix, they probably produce two seasons, well, one season, and then split it into two and pretend that they renewed it, which is the Netflix trick, and why they can turn over these shows so fast into multiple seasons. So probably I would expect a new season next year if it was successful enough, even though we've had the corona disrupt our entertainment supply.
Oh, the corona.
So. I've heard good things, and I've been trying to convince Kristen that we need to check it out sometime soon. So glad to hear directly from someone whose opinion we would trust.
Right is value.
Thank you. That actually makes me feel a lot better today.
Oh, good.
Sure.
Okay.
Next up is The Infinite Loop.
This one is a comic book series. Of course, Aaron was guilting me a few weeks back for not using my Comixology Unlimited nearly enough. So I've been checking into some of the originals and such on there. So The Infinite Loop is a sci-fi love story kind of time travel. So the loop is a time travel loop or a time paradox loop. I don't know. It gets confusing. Basically, the premise is you're following a main character whose job it is to go around and fix temporal anomalies that crop up. And while she's out on a mission, it turns out that one of these anomalies is actually a person, which she's never seen before. And they wind up falling in love. And she,
you know, as you do.
As you do, and she abandons her job and goes on the run. And spoiler full alert, turns out that the folks creating the anomalies are actually her, name's Teddy, if I remember right, her from other timelines, trying to fix things so that the anomaly who gets named Anno doesn't die. And it's a whole convoluted thing. But part of that, where you say it sounds confusing, is that I wanted to like this. I really wanted to like it, but it felt, the first quarter to maybe half of the book felt pretty strong, but definitely in the back half, at a minimum, it felt like I was only getting about every other page of the necessary story, even accounting for time travel shenanigans back and forth. It made it very hard to track. I would flip to the next page and say, wait, what? How did they get here? What are they doing? It just felt like they were rushing too much to fit it maybe within a six issue series. And so they trimmed some connective tissue that was really necessary. Like, if you're going to have time travel and paradox and all this back and forth, I feel like you need to have that strong connective tissue to make it intelligible to the reader. And it kind of loses that. But I do definitely want to give a huge props, though, to the artist whose last name I'm sure I'll butcher. Her first name is Elsa Charité. I don't know. I assume it's French. And I am always the worst at French pronunciations here in Missouri, since we purposefully butcher them. We, by the way, one of the suburbs here is named Beaudark, as we say it. But anyway, it's kind of a Bruce Timm, Darwin Cook sort of style, very stylized, like animated cartoonish sort of style, very retro. That I really, really love. So I give a huge props to the art, if nothing else.
All right. I'm going to do a movie. I finally watched, after a million years, The End of the Tour on Netflix. It's the movie with Jesse Eisenberg and, I can't think of his real name, Marshall from How I Met Your Mother. One of you will know.
Oh, crud. I should know.
Jason, something.
Siegel? Yes.
Siegel, yeah.
All right, good. It's those two, and it's based on a book where the author interviews David Foster Wallace, and it's just the, like, two or three days they spend together and all their conversations, look into what it's like to get famous for a book. You didn't think it was really possible to get famous for a book, and like worrying about how people look at different thoughts that go into that. And I thought it was really, really well done. It even doesn't gloss over. Buster Wallace had a problematic relationship with women. I haven't done enough research into exactly how much, because honestly, I had no idea until like a year ago. There's been a lot going on.
So, but a problematic risk for Lynn, which the film does not gloss over, it treats him as someone who can control it, which could lead to abusive obsession or whatever. And I thought it was really, really well done, absolutely worth a watch, and is on Netflix. Since everyone has time, I highly suggest it.
I'm surprised it took you so long to watch a movie about David Foster Wallace.
As I was really liking him, I found out that he stalked a woman, and it put me off doing a lot with it. I was actually going to, after the AP exam, I was going, like, we read several of his pieces during the school year, and I found a really excellent, I believe, the Vox piece called What Do We Do When the Art We Love is Created by Monsters, which looks at various lit theory lenses as a way to look at how much we should pay attention to the creator in work we enjoy. And it references and links Foster Wallace's crimes within that article. And it was going to be like our final like argument of the year was going to be to what extent should we take this into account. But, you know, I don't think I'm doing that from home. That seems like
a little too complicated.
It's not even a little too complicated. I don't know what anyone's home life is. And I don't want to be like, hey, want to talk about someone being abusive and art that portrays that without me being like.
Yeah, I understand what you mean.
I mean, I also, like, whenever I do anything like that, this is fairly controversial among many teachers, but I don't give a shit. I will trigger warning a couple days before and be like, hey, these are the themes that are going to come up. You guys have it in a couple days. You're talking, email me. You don't have to say a single word. Why? You can literally just nod at me right now, and I will make up an excuse we will never do this unit. And
it's fair.
That's happened once. It's happened once, but I don't know how to do that like accurately online. I don't really want to do that right now.
That's fair.
So, but it was going to be a really cool unit. I was going to start with, you know, it's getting better all the time.
Yeah, I do not recall.
You remember the verse in the middle where John Lennon talks about how he beat his first wife?
Not off the top of my head, but that may.
Yeah, right in the middle, I used to be cruel to my woman. I beat her and kept her apart.
The things you loved.
Man, I was mean, but I'm changing. I see I'm doing the best that I can. That's apparently what It's Getting Better is about. I'm trying not to beat women.
Well, he failed. He also,
yes, he continued. He continued to beat women and. Also his children, so not a good person at all, but like his legacy amongst people is like, especially like any kid that would have heard of him would be untarnished. Their parents would be like, oh yeah, he's great, right? If they had heard of him. And if they haven't, then like there's a million other examples. I was going to do R. Kelly, I was going to do Kobe Bryant, like it was going to be a whole bunch of like little examples. It was going to look at legacy. I think it's a much more interesting conversation to have after the person is dead. I think if the person is alive, it's much easier to go, you should probably try not to benefit. Right? But after the person is dead, I think it's a really interesting in-depth conversation that involves a lot of like ethical decisions and literary analysis decisions that I think are worthwhile for any.
Yeah, I mean, it's easier to have these conversations when they're dead. So, but it's actually more necessary when they're alive. So.
See, I think it's easier when they're alive. When they're alive, you know someone is a monster. Please stop supporting them. Like, you're helping them be successful. Stop that. Like, I don't see the hard part, especially necessarily when they're alive. When they're gone, I mean,
dead people can't argue back at you, and dead people lower. The stakes get lower with that when you're dead people. I mean, they're still extremely high. It's a different kind of stakes, I guess you could say.
Okay, I would take
I don't think there are any economic stakes too if it's something that's generating income.
Right. So it would have been a cool unit. It's something I will end up doing next year.
Yeah. No, it sounds like a very cool unit.
That was my. I want to talk about a cool idea for the week. By the way, that was my lead into that. How do you guys interact with the art of those who are terrible people after they're gone? Or if while they're here, if you think that's important.
I guess I'm in some ways lucky in, you know, some of the more prominent suspects, like, you know, folks that you mentioned just now, a lot of them are involved in stuff that I just don't particularly care for to start with, right? Like, I don't really care for Woody Allen movies. Like, I don't really care for R. Kelly music. I don't
Johnny Depp.
Follow basketball, so I never really cared about Kobe. Like, it just happens to be stuff I haven't cared much about to start with, so I haven't necessarily needed to examine those. I guess the closest might be something like Cosby, but I mean, I guess there's a vague notion of having enjoyed the Cosby Show as a kid. But I'm so distant from that and haven't really been like dying to revisit that even before all of that became public that. Yeah, I guess that is not something I've needed to examine as hard as is necessary.
I had always had thoughts about it, but I never, like, even Michael Jackson or John Lennon didn't force it for me the same way Louis C.K. did. Because I loved Louis C.K. He was a wreck.
I think it's complicated. And I don't think that there's I think trying to come up with a consistent answer is more, I think, tends to make you more of a hypocrite than trying to be, to say that it's complicated. And in many ways, it's a case by case basis. But for me, my general rule, I find it easier when the person's work is more abstracted from themselves as a person. So for, like, Louis C.K. is a really good example. It's really easy for me to write off people like Louis C.K. Because, like, Louis C.K., the persona is what he's selling. And then to learn that persona is, you know, not just an exaggerate, like, the comedic isn't just a exaggeration that, you know, ups his funny qualities and flattens his undesirable qualities, but simply masks extreme vice, not just, you know, normal human foibles, but extreme vice that has really destroyed people's careers. It's really easy to be like, fuck Louis C.K. Like, we're done. Like, that's easy. It's harder, you know, for, like, filmmakers, animators, things like that, where, like, even Woody Allen, who's someone, one, I don't like Woody Allen's perspective in general, and I think Woody Allen is a piece of shit. I'm sorry, well, I'm doubly cursing here, but
I mean, is shit even a curse?
Yeah.
At the same time, I've never really
cared about shit.
Like, a lot of what we think about when it comes to movies, like, a film auteur is, like, mostly a lie, right? Like, Woody Allen productions are a variety of different people, right? Like, it's complicated. But for my attitude is I try to avoid people that I know that they are awful. But you can't take those experiences away from yourself and trying to be like, oh, I used to enjoy, or this meant a lot to me, but I found out that this person was a horrible human being, so thus I have to cut that aspect of my life out. No, I don't think that's what you have to do. You have to just adjust yourself going forward. And one of the things for me is my relationship with J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter. I was actually a latecomer to really enjoying Harry Potter. It wasn't until college, actually, that I got really into Harry Potter, but I got very into it, and it was an important part of my life for, like, 15 years. Well, let's see, when I got out of school, I got into it, like, a dozen. So, like, you know, 10 years, something like that, and, you know, remained an important fandom to me, but then, like, her turn in recent years towards reaction and bigotry, it's just I can't support Rowling going forward. But that doesn't mean that my enjoyment of Harry Potter goes away, or the fact that the being part of that fandom meant a lot to me and was important to me at points in my life. Like, those were, you know, those were great experiences and important experiences and foundational experiences. They're not invalidated by who J.K. Rowling became or who she maybe always was. The same as enjoying the Cosby Show, or things like that.
Yeah, one thing you did get me thinking about there, particularly in film and TV and such, and The Cosby Show, I think, is a pretty good example. I do think it does kind of shift some based on when the knowledge became public, more or less, right? So, like, Cosby, for instance, is a good example. The Cosby Show, I feel less conflicted about and feel that other people should maybe feel less conflicted about because so many other people, as you said, are involved in something like that, right? Like, is it worth it for me to hold Cosby's, you know, a much later knowledge of Cosby's transgressions against that entire cast and those writers and so on and whoever else might be earning some kind of residuals out of it, that type of thing, versus where heaven forbid he were to somehow be putting out a new show now and I were to support that. Also, then by association, everyone else involved in that new show is aware of and have made the conscious choice to support that as well. That seems much more clear cut to me than throwing out all the other previously involved people with the bathwater, so to speak.
I think it's unfortunately a risk you take. Oh, I have something else to prop. I think it's unfortunately a risk you take when collaborating. That's sometimes the person. I mean, look, we don't even have to go far for this. We can literally go to. It's a risk you take.
Our own experience.
Yeah. For anyone not familiar, we used to play a card game together. But when you collaborate with people, you can only know what others so well, and you take the risk that some of those are not going to be great and will to some extent be tainted by association.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it happens.
Mm-hmm. I have another thing to prop that just came up. Do you mind if I jump in? Because I'm going to forget.
Sure. All
right. I want to prop A, Scrubs. Yeah. B, Shea Serrano is a phenomenal writer who just released a PDF of Scrubs collection of 10 essays that is absolutely fantastic and I highly recommend. Also a wonderful human being who treats F. Donald Trump and anyone who stands with him at least a couple times a week and then blocks everyone who is obnoxious. He also gives massive amounts of money, about $15,000 away to low-wage workers, just cash-apping them on Twitter since the coronavirus has started. But also, and I haven't had a chance to explain, I'm just... Yeah, he's amazing. He's one of the, like, if he were a monster, I would be hurt. I think he is an amazing movie. And he's released multiple books on hip-hop, basketball, movies, such. And he's just generally a consistent person. He admits his flaws. He works really hard to try and fix them. But also, one more Scrubs thing. Donald Faison and Zach Braff have started a Scrubs podcast. That the first like episode the West Wing just came one? Out for. I don't know the West Wing one, but they have started their Scrubs podcast where I believe they're rewatching going through episodes.
Yeah, it's like the West Wing one. Yeah, the West Wing did. The guy who replaced Rob Lowe on West Wing did a podcast like that.
Oh, fair enough.
That sounds fabulous.
So I am very, very, very excited to listen to that podcast. I don't know how the hell I'm going to have time to podcast during coronavirus. Not like Noah's like, hey, want to listen to a podcast, Daddy? But, also, if you need something upbeat, it's on Hulu to watch during this and you haven't seen Scrubs, please watch Scrubs. It is heartbreaking regularly, but one of the most uplifting beautiful shows.
I wholeheartedly second that.
Roy does not like Scrubs. Next prop.
I was never fond of it. Yes, that is
correct. I know. I can. It's not your sense of humor. All right. Next up, something Roy is extremely fond of: Persona 5.
Yes. So Persona 5 Royal came out today. I just want to prop it. Played about a couple hours of it today. It's amazing. It just reminded me of how much I love Persona 5 and just how utterly smooth it is as a game experience and how strong it starts as a story. And so again, like, if you played Persona 5, particularly if you haven't played it recently, I would definitely suggest buying it. And if you've not played Persona 5 before, just buy this version and play it. It is probably the best JRPG, you know, since probably Persona 4 came out. So that would be Persona 4 came out in 2008. When did Golden come out? Golden came out
16, 17, no?
11.
Really?
No, 12. 2012. Came out in 2012, 11.
Persona 4 Golden. Okay. Persona 5 came out like 17, right?
Yeah, 17. Yeah. So 5 came out 17. And yeah, it's just an amazingly smooth and fantastic experience. You want to play PS4, you like JRPGs, or if you are an anime fan and wants to try a JRPG, it is a great place to start. Fantastic. Super prop.
Oh.
I'll have more to say later, I'm sure.
Why is it not on the Switch yet?
Persona 4, I don't even think it's been ported. Persona 5, I don't even think it's been ported over to the Xbox. I think it's exclusive PlayStation. That's why. So that's probably why Atlas has an agreement with Sony. So,
fair enough. That's very frustrating because it would be so easy to port.
Yeah, I mean, there was the PS3 version of it, so.
At least release 4, right? Like, for hell, release 3.
Well, man, that would be great. Persona 4, I think, is also only on PlayStation platforms. Yeah, it's only on. Yeah, I just think the series has an exclusivity agreement with Sony. But I mean, people thought that when Joker became a character in Smash Brothers that they would do it, but. I guess maybe Sony's paying Atlas, or Atlas just doesn't think that it will make them enough money.
It makes me very sad because I would really love to play that game. I was also going to get a PS4 for this time, but like, if the TV is on, it's to know it's cartoons until after bedtime, and after bedtime, I'm either on the computer with you gentlemen, hanging out with my wife. She's not going to watch me play video.
That's fair.
The Switch is what I can get away with. Well, with my son, he's, you know, otherwise. But. Oh. All right. I'm going to super quick do Bloodstained. Bloodstained is another, I think it's actually every system, Metroidvania. It is very similar to Castlevania. It is nowhere near as good as Hollow Knight, but it's pretty okay. I'm going to semi-prop it. If you end up playing Hollow Knight and want something similar that feels playable and good, I think Bloodstained is worth your time. I'm relatively early. I really don't super enjoy the combat, but I like going back and forth, figuring things out, the usual for this. And it's got a lot of weapons, which I know is silly and like not really, you know, a huge difference, but the weapons all feel different, and the different feel of the weapons and magic really does that. And you can switch on the fly.
Cool.
It feels very Castlevania, but not nearly the same plot. It is the better Castlevania version. All right. Slop or good night, Roy?
The game?
Slop it. Yep, the game. I played about three. We got PlayStation Now because there's a bunch of like PS3 era games that my wife was interested in, and it's a bunch of cool stuff that like I was interested in too. So we got PS Now just to be able to have some games that are just like not necessarily worth spending retail price on. And I was in a mood while I was playing around trying to find something to sort of fill the time. I was like, you know what? I'm kind of in a superhero game mood. And I was like, I've already beaten the Spider-Man game. Oh, you know what? Hey, look, Arkham Knight. I enjoyed Arkham City. I'll play Arkham Knight. Cool. I'm in the mood for this. Lasted about 3 hours, and then the Batmobile controls and the Batmobile puzzles made me want to die. And I was like, this is not worth it. I don't care. Forget this game. Hard slot.
I will say, as much as I love those Batman games in general and their setup, the Batmobile is by far the worst part of that game and that series, probably. I only used it when absolutely required for particular gameplay. Otherwise, I just traveled the usual way, you know, the zip lines or whatever.
Yeah, the crappy Spider-Man way.
I hate every game that does that. Did you guys ever play Golf Story?
Nope.
Okay. You should. It's one of those games that I can't imagine not liking. But the golf is incredible. Like, you golf and kill zombies. Like, it's really fun. It's an RPG based around golf. It's truly excellent, except that once in a while, it's like, hey, here's an obstacle course or frisbee golf. And it's just like, you had such good gameplay, and I know you want to try to do cool new things, but it's miserable. I hated those parts. Like, I didn't finish the game. I got to one part where it was just, here's a stupid obstacle course. You have to restart it every time you mess up. And I was like, I'm not doing it. Game. Thank you for trying. Like, it's just, I hate that. Like, every game that does anything like that drives me completely crazy. You've got a core mechanic, develop it, the shit out of it, and don't give me, like, a million mini games that I have to do. If mini games are optional, great. I hate half. So, I will join you in slapping her. I put that one.
There you go.
All right.
And last up, the Pathfinder Adventure card game. We are
done. Yeah. I can talk just real quick again about that. I'll prop it. My wife and I got it as a board game to play together. My wife's been actually playing D&D, which is super cool, online with some folks. And it does a pretty good job of simulating Pathfinder / Dungeons & Dragons, but as a card game. And it's something that we're going to dig in more, and I'll have more to talk about. But so far, I like it. I will say that the introductory scenario is well done, but the introductory, like, instructions and setup stuff isn't really, and doesn't really necessarily do a good job of sort of answering some critical questions. But, you know, I couldn't imagine if you were not an experienced card gamer trying to figure out some of the stuff just purely off trying to use the, like, learn to play rules. I think you might find it a little confusing, or super confusing, actually, because we found it a little confusing. But other than that, that was just really, once we got going with it, it was really fun, and we're going to play it again later this week. So,
I've heard a lot of good things about it. Haven't delved into it, but a lot of those, like, solo and co-op card games are super fun.
Yep. It's, I actually liked it a little bit better than the FFG style versions of that, so. But not saying I love Arkham Horror, and I've liked Lord of the Rings, but I played it, so.
I have played either, but everyone yells at me that Arkham Horror is, like, the greatest game ever.
Fun. It's fun. It's very RPG-ish for an FFG style game.
All right. I think talking about FFG again, I definitely put this in the danger zone, right?
Ooh, yes. Yes, I think so.